the ports are so congested. There's like 42 ships off Long Beach Port, and usually there's only one.
He said there are no mattresses of that size in the whole country. Everything's on ships, but they don't know when it will arrive.
There are always disruptions that happen in the supply chain. I mean, who expected the Ever Given to get stuck in the Suez Canal?
Ocean carriers, those ships that carry containers, are gigantic. Like, really big. Until you're actually at a port, staring straight up at one, you don't realize that these ships that carry everything stretch the length of 4 football fields. They're about as wide as a Manhattan city block, and they are just jam-packed with containers. Those containers, which were only invented about 70 years ago, move about 90% of the goods that you wear, that you use, that you eat, everything from raw material to Furbies, at least 20 years ago. But this year, this gigantic, well-oiled, and picture-perfect operation had a major wrench thrown into it. You are listening to Ship Happens, a podcast miniseries exploring global trade and what happens when things go wrong. I am Eitan Buckman, freight geek extraordinaire and chief marketing officer at Freightos, the global freight booking platform. And this is the episode you've been waiting for. We've danced around e-commerce, we've toyed with air cargo, but ocean freight moves the world. We're going to show you just how big it is, how much we depend on it, and how so many things went wrong even before COVID. Container shipping is the workhorse of global trade, and despite its size, it usually moves around without us noticing. Today, we are getting to the heart of the supply chain. We're going to explore how ocean freight works, the journey that a container makes, and why it's been the subject of so much controversy this year. But first, let's unpack the basics. Meet Peter, our ocean expert for today.
My name is Peter Hove Hildebrandt. I've spent the majority of my working life with Maersk the last 21 years, started as a trainee back in 1999. And the last 10-11 months has been my own venture, along with a few partners, on building what we today call Project Aviato, which in essence is a fund that will invest into the entire supply chain.
So Peter's been in freight since before iPhones were a thing and long before Finding Nemo. And what this means is that he gets it. Before he jumps in, it's important to know that Maersk is the largest ocean liner in the world, or at least tied for first, clocking in at close to 17% of all global containers. This is also a very consolidated industry. If you take the top 7 ocean liners, they control over 75% of the market. And it's also a hard industry for new players to get into, since owning ships and terminals is a massive capital expense. For example, it can cost over $1 million to just paint one of those ships. But before I distract myself with talking about painting ships, here's the basics of how a container full of Peppa Pig dolls moves around the world.
An importer needs a supply of the goods, whatever he or she is selling, and he gets a container sent out to his factory at the origin. That container is put on a truck, and that is then moved into a container terminal. And at the container terminal, subject that there is a vessel available, it will be loaded onto that vessel. It will be sailed across the ocean. And then subject that there is vessel and berth availability, so there's space in the receiving terminal, it will be discharged off the ship and put into the terminal there. And then at some point, it will be picked up by either a truck or put onto a rail and moved into the distribution center of the importer.
Now remember, at this point, the container still needs to get unpacked and then potentially moved to another distribution center before you order it and finally get to unbox it, give it to your niece, and watch her play with the Peppa Pig box instead of the doll. The magic here is that these containers are standardized. Most of them are 40 or 20 feet long, and they can be stacked over 9 columns high in the ship. They all lock into each other or lock onto a truck when they're moved around, and they can be easily taken off with a crane. Sometimes those cranes pick up 4 at a time and drop them onto a truck to be carted somewhere else. Now, even though it seems obvious to us right now, containers on ships are surprisingly recent. They were actually only invented in 1956, and only in the 1970s did they really take off. In other words, Ziploc bags, waffle balls, WD-40, and Tupperware containers all were invented before there was a really effective way to ship them. And without containers to load goods and take them off the ships and really move them around easily, every time a ship was loaded, it was effectively a game of Tetris. Fast forward to today, and the massive economies of scale of these ships means that they can carry a lot. one ship can easily carry 24,000 20-foot equivalent units. That is enough to hold nearly 150 million sneakers. Now, in order to move containers around the world, you do need to have some basic requirements. You need to have a ship. You need to have space on that ship to move it on. You need a chassis. That's those little truck beds that hold the containers. You need space at the port to dock. That's the berths. And space at the port to unload. And of course, people to make the whole thing tick. And we'll see later that that part is not so easy. Typically, when a smaller mid-sized company imports, they won't work directly with the ocean liner, although this is changing. Instead, they'll work with what's called a freight forwarder.
My name is Charles Morel. I'm the CEO of X Freight. We are a digital freight forwarder. A freight forwarder would best be described as a travel agent for freight. You have all these moving pieces in the freight ecosystem, vessel operators who own big, large container ships. You have trucking companies. Then you have airlines who just want to move from airport to airport. So what a freight forwarder does is takes all of these components and mixes them together in order to provide one cohesive move from the factory, wherever it is in the world, to the store shelf or to the Amazon or any other distribution center in the world.
You haven't called your travel agent for years, so you might be thinking, well, why do I need a freight forwarder? And the answer is that when your flight gets delayed, you can go buy a magazine and wait. Cargo can't take care of itself, and it also relies on an incredibly complex web of different providers, like trucking companies, airlines, ocean liners, and documentation so complicated that it makes the DMV look like kindergarten. But let's get back to Peter, so he can explain one of the most shocking parts of ocean freight, at least for me. For the longest time, its basic operating procedures have encouraged inefficiency.
I think what we as individual consumers have become quite familiar with in any transaction that we make is that if I buy a plane ticket from Copenhagen to New York and I've paid for it, I will get that seat. I won't show up in the gate. And then, sorry, Peter, there's no seat for you, which historically has been the situation in the container shipping industry.
This is not an important part of international freight, but it really helps illuminate just how strange some parts of the industry can be.
So you would have situations where shippers take out an option or basically book with multiple carriers before a departure out of a port. And then they would call the option saying, I'm going to choose this one that either is the cheapest, or if it's a space situation, the one that can provide me with the space, which would leave everyone else where the booking has been received without a container that's supposed to be there and take up a slot.
Just to make sure we're crystal clear on what Peter just said, if you are shipping a container of goods, you can buy the space and then decide last minute not to ship it, and you won't get charged for the space you bought. Similarly, a container liner can sell you the space, you can bring your container to ship, and they might not let it come on board. That is crazy.
It's very difficult to wrap your head around if you're not in the industry, but historically, that's just been the way it was. And the enforcement mechanisms and the ability to ensure this two-way commitment was never there, which means there was also no such thing as a cancellation fee. This just didn't exist.
This is just one small example of how some things in ocean freight are set up pretty precariously from the get-go. But it's not so easy to build a container liner that can do it better. Building and maintaining a container ship is an expensive endeavor. And as an industry, it is very, very much held to the mercy of supply and demand. For example, just 5 years ago, in September 2016, one of the world's largest ocean liners, Hanjin, went out of business due to low rates. At the time, it was cheaper to put a container on a ship and sail it around the world instead of paying for storage. You're talking somewhere in the vicinity of $1,500. But of course, as you know now, over the past 2 years, rates have climbed up to $20,000 per container. You also need to know that the communication around freight can be a little bit wonky. Until recently, when you wanted to ship something, you sent an email or you made a call. And when something goes wrong, depending on how bad it is, you send an email or you make a call. Multiply this by over 220 million containers shipped every year, and things are messy. Here's Eric Johnson. He's the tech editor for the Journal of Commerce and a logistics technology enthusiast who's obsessed with the idiosyncrasies of freight. So when I asked him what the biggest problem to solve in global freight was, regardless of COVID, he did not bat an eye. It's something that we all hate. email.
A lot of problems in this industry result from email. Email strings, email chains, unanswered emails, a process that is reliant on someone emailing someone something and that person not getting it, or it going to the wrong address. It creates a customer service issue that escalates to various parties. And then that translates into actual business problems. A container doesn't get picked up when it's supposed to. Fees are incurred on that container because it didn't get picked up. Figuring out who to assign blame to retroactively in that situation. And then the commercial reality of maybe the goods inside that container spoiled or they missed a promotional window. And so you're not going to be able to charge as much for it as you did even 3 weeks ago. Essentially, what we've seen is that one type of bottleneck spiderwebs into these other bottlenecks. And people tend to focus on the outside of the spiderweb and not necessarily look at where the start of the spiderweb is. There is a case in front of the FMC, which is the Federal Maritime Commission, regarding something called detention and demurrage, which is often called free time. It's basically the amount of time that a cargo owner has to pick up a container that's arrived at a port and move it out of that port and take it to their own facility so they can unload the goods or move it on to the next stop. It would take me 45 minutes to explain all the particulars of this case, but essentially it boils down to a set of containers that arrived at a particular date and the time it took for the shipping line to alert the owner of the goods that the container had arrived and was ready to be picked up. And it really boils down to a very simple problem. That email that was supposed to be triggered by the container being ready for pickup went to a wrong email address. It went to the general sales inquiry email address and not the person who coordinates the movement of that container out of the port. That simple issue spiderwebbed into a 12-day delay that incurred a bunch of fees. It led to this super long email chain between about 12 different parties. There were a lot of unanswered emails at first, and then all of a sudden there was a flurry of activity, emails passing each other in the night. And the upshot of it is that this container didn't get picked up 10 days earlier than it could have been because that initial notice was not sent to the right email address.
That is one container, just one container out of the millions around the world. So just to recap, we have an industry that is very concentrated, that is not necessarily built around maximizing full efficiency, and still relies on painfully slow communication for the most part. And I threw a lot of information at you, but keep in mind that this is important in understanding why supply chain issues exist pre-COVID. And with that in mind, one more thing you need to know is that it is really, really hard to quickly modify how much space or capacity is available. There are about 2,000 large container ships that can carry 5,000 containers or more. So when there aren't enough containers to ship, they typically get left at port. And that's exactly what happened in the early days of COVID, when close to 10% of all ships were not operational. I like to think of it as an 18-year bottle of scotch. You might see today that more people are drinking your single malt, but in order to hit demand, you need 18 years of planning. A container liner doesn't take 18 years, but it does take a couple years, which means that you can't rapidly scale up when you start running out of space. And space did run out. Let's pick back up with Charles.
I was actually on vacation in Bahamas when it started to sink in that, oh my God, everyone's closing down their borders and people are getting scared and they're stopping travel. It really didn't start impacting freight until around April. A lot of the airlines started canceling their flights. So there was less and less capacity for us to move the freight. At the same time, people started cutting back on their buying on ocean freight. So we had available capacity on ocean freight, ironically, at that time. A lot of buyers thought the economy was going to crash. You didn't know what was going to happen. After the initial shock, where everyone started working from home, people started to notice they had a whole lot more disposable income since they weren't going out every night and traveling, and started buying a lot of stuff online. Then all the retailers realized, oh my God, the demand is now bigger than normal. And they started buying waves and waves of freight, of cargo that needed to import it. And that's when the ocean vessels started to get full. The ocean liners saw the demands drop in April. because everyone stopped buying. So they started pulling vessels out of the water and docking them. And then come June, everyone's like, we need more space. We need to move more freight. And then the vessel operators started putting more vessels into the water.
Here's where the number of ships in port started to drop.
But as the vessel operators started putting more vessels in the water, it wasn't a matter of space anymore. It was a matter of getting the containers off the vessels.
So you may recall that before we talked about needing more ships, and that when you need more ships, you need containers too. At some point in the middle of 2020, these containers, the same ones that were only invented in 1956, but have played such a key role in scaling, were all stuck on ships. And then there just wasn't space for those ships to dock or load.
So think of it this way. The capacity remained the same. The number of vessels remained the same, but they couldn't unload the containers at the ports fast enough. So vessels started stacking up outside the port of Long Beach and Los Angeles, just like everyone is well aware of now, but they started stacking up and the vessels couldn't make that loop from Asia into the US West Coast and back and forth as regularly as they could.
And of course, cranes and trucks at the ports need people, and people can get COVID.
And then at the ports, they're doing their best to do it, but there was COVID outbreaks at some of the ports. Some people were scared to work, so the trucking companies didn't have as many people on hand. There was mass chaos, and to this day, there's still a lot of labor disruption because of what COVID has displaced from the market.
To recap, not only were ships in the wrong places, containers were suddenly in short supply and located in all the wrong places. One crazy example. Ocean liners were charging close to 10 times more to ship a container from China to the US than they were shipping in the other direction. That feeling of urgency and potential profit for shipping from China to the US meant that it was more worthwhile to ship an empty container back to China as soon as possible than to let it get loaded in the United States. So empty containers were in short supply in the US, and that meant that US exports in early 2021 were getting hit too. So we have this perfect storm, high demand, an inability to unload ships, not enough containers, COVID outbreaks, typhoons at some ports. And now to add on to all of that, the truck drivers servicing these ports just couldn't keep up. Now there's a reason for that. During this crisis, the allure of trucking lost some of its glimmer. Just like the rest of the market, workers were underpaid and overworked at a mass exodus. One of the best explanations of this popped up in an article at the end of October. Written by a truck driver who goes by Ryan Johnson, the article was titled, "I'm a 20-year truck driver, I will tell you why America's shipping crisis will not end." It went wild in certain circles. I got this article from at least 10 friends, and since we couldn't hunt down the author, our producer, Daphna Farkas, is going to read a couple of excerpts here.
Let's start with understanding some things about ports. Outside of dedicated port trucking companies, most trucking companies won't touch shipping containers. There's a reason for that. Think of going to the port as going to Walmart on Black Friday, but imagine only one cashier for thousands of customers. Think about the lines, except at a port, there are at least three lines to get a container in or out. The first line is the in-gate, where hundreds of trucks daily have to pass through 5 to 10 available gates. The second line is waiting to pick up your container. The third line is waiting to get out. For each of these lines, the wait time is a minimum of an hour, and I've waited up to 8 hours in the first line just to get into the port. Some ports are worse than others, but excessive wait times are not uncommon. It's a rare day when a driver gets in and out in under 2 hours. By rare day, I mean maybe a handful of times a year. Ports don't even begin to have enough workers to keep the ports fluid.
So when you hear about port log jams, it's not just about the container ships and the containers. It's also about how do you get those containers into the port or out of them? How do you get the trucks and the truckers working super, super efficiently? And that is hard.
I'm fortunate enough to be a Teamster, a union driver, an employee paid by the hour. Most port drivers are independent contractors, leased onto a carrier who's paying them by the load. Whether their load takes 2 hours, 14 hours, or 3 days to complete, they get paid the same and they have to pay 90% of their truck operating expenses. The carrier might pay the other 10%, but usually less. The rates paid to non-union drivers for shipping container transport are usually extremely low. In majority of cases, these drivers don't come close to my union wages. They pay for all their own repairs and fuel and all truck-related expenses. I honestly don't know how many of them can even afford to show up for work. There's no guarantee of any wage, not even minimum wage. And in many cases, these drivers make far below minimum wage. In some cases, they work 70-hour weeks and still end up owing money to their carrier. So when the coastal ports started getting clogged up last spring due to the impact of COVID on businesses everywhere, drivers started refusing to show up. Congestion got so bad that instead of being able to do 3 loads a day, they could only do one. They took a 2/3 pay cut, and most of these drivers were working 12 hours a day or more. While carriers were charging increased pandemic shipping rates, none of those rate increases went to the driver's wages.
That's the equivalent of a waiter who is paid on tips alone and is forced to work at a restaurant that only lets in one diner at a time.
Many drivers simply quit. However, while the pickup rate for containers severely decreased, they were still being offloaded from the boats, and it's only gotten worse. From personal experience, what used to take me 20 to 30 minutes to pick up at a warehouse can now take 3 to 4 hours. It means as a freight driver, I cannot pick up as much freight in a day as I used to. And since I can't get as much freight on my truck, the whole supply chain is backed up. Freight simply isn't moving.
And that is where we're going to leave you. The state of the ocean freight industry, with all of its quirks, starting to bend under the pressure of COVID. A huge industry with some very, very strange idiosyncrasies that moves the world, but that we never see.
In the next episode of Ship Happens.
On March 21st, the Ever Given, one of these massive container ships, ran aground in the Suez Canal. You've seen the memes, but you don't know how it impacts international trade, how it brought a core artery in global freight to a complete and grinding stop. We will pick up there, unravel how international trade recovered, and how everyone from the White House to ocean liners tried to bring things back to normal, and of course, how it impacted the goods that get to your door.
Ship Happens is produced by Freightos, the global freight booking platform, making international shipping faster, more cost-effective, and reliable. For more, visit us at freightos.com.